days. This doesn't quite fit on you. We'll have to work on that too. Some of you may remember that in the fall, I decided that I would use these talks in the winter and then again next fall as a series of reflections and meditations on themes related to religious and spiritual life that I've been thinking about for a long time, more than 40 years, actually 50 years, some of them 67 years, well, maybe not quite that. I was an odd little kid in some ways. I had some very, very distinct and rather powerful experiences as a four-year-old that I know still influence my reflections on spiritual life and where we are in the world, where we find love, and our need to connect. So all of this is kind of a great conversation, I hope. Or at least conversation starter. The late New Testament scholar Marcus Borg concluded his masterwork, which was simply titled Jesus, with a comment on life as a great conversation. He said this: "We are all part of an unending conversation. That is an image of human life that is a parable for our own lives. Being born is like entering a parlor where there's already a conversation going on. The conversation began long before we were born, and it will continue long after we are gone. The conversation is about life itself, about what is real, what is worth paying attention to, how we shall live, and what this is all about." So in many ways, Borg describes what I've attempted to do in these talks, that is, engage us in conversations about the things that matter, about the ideas that orient our hearts and lives, about the source of our commitments, about the place of inspiration and insight regarding ourselves and others, where those insights come from. So today I want to talk about where we look for religious and spiritual and moral insight with the idea of embodying our spirituality. And I want to start by looking at an old dichotomy in philosophy and religious studies on transcendence and immanence. So just bear with me for a little bit. Religions typically call upon transcendence, that is a kind of vertical and hierarchical dimension, as the location of the sacred. That is a reality beyond or outside of ordinary experience. Recalling our discussion last time about the idea of God, we associate the divine, the sacred, or the holy in hierarchical terms. God is above, we are below. God is beyond, we are here. One of the enduring problems, though, that religions face is, if that is so, then how do you connect the transcendent, which is outside of our experience, into our experience, into the immanent? So the question of transcendence and immanence has a long history in philosophy as well as in religious studies. Some of you are students of philosophy, and you might remember that transcendence and immanence was a topic of special importance to European philosophers, especially in the 19th century with Hegel, Karl Marx. It was also taken up by the French feminist philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. And in that lineage of thinkers, transcendence has to do with the creative, generative activities of humans. That's where our creative spirit is. All those things that elevate human beings and human consciousness from the mundane and profane into the sacred. That's transcendence. Ecstatic experience is transcendent. It takes us out of our ordinary lives. Immanence has to do with labor, work, the earth, the mundane, the profane, those activities that are necessary for mere physical existence, one of the criticisms of de Beauvoir by later feminists, in fact, was that the tendency to associate the mundane with women and women's activities. Historically, that has been so, including childbirth, child rearing. Those are mundane. They're not transcendent experiences. In religion and religious studies, the problem of transcendence and immanence also has to do with the ineffability of God. Again, God is outside of anything we can imagine. The notion of God beyond physical and finite existence, including even our conceptual ability, God is always greater than that which I can conceive. But immanence has to do with our experience here in this world, including our bodies, the physical reality of life as humans. The definitions of God, it follows, especially in the West, place God in the completely other, transcendent outside, beyond our comprehension, beyond even depiction. You know, you shall make no graven image. Islam, Judaism, Christianity are very wary of even trying to imagine the divine or make images of the divine. If that's so, here's the problem. How can a person know, much less worship such a God who is beyond our experience? So the problem, how do you get a God whose transcendence renders the idea outside of our capacity available to our experience? If you look at ancient Judaism, there's this idea of the Shekinah. That is, the appearances of God are metaphors and physical manifestations. So a cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night, a bush that burns without being consumed, a voiceless voice. Later Judaism, God, the hierarchical transcendent God, becomes known through, the law. So God made law. Law is immanent. It has to do with experience. The thou shalt and thou shalt not. God is known as law, and the commandments become a way of life. To know God is to be obedient to the law. Something similar happens in Islam, a bit different, but God in Islam is known through the messengers, and ultimately through the book, the Quran. That's how you know God immanently. God made book. In liberation is the term. But many religions take a different turn, declaring that God became a person in order to connect the sacred to the profane, to connect God and human experience. And the word for that is incarnation. It's not unique to Christianity at all. It's quite common. First, a little something about incarnation. The word literally means embodied in flesh. The root word carne is Latin for meat or flesh. Incarnation means to make meat. The word carnival, for example, comes from that same root word. Carnival is where you eat meat before you begin to fast. Ash Wednesday, just this last week, is the beginning of the period of fasting. And so the days leading up to Ash Wednesday are carnival, where you let it all hang out, you eat meat. But incarnation, again, is to make something into flesh. The classicist mythologist Ian Fraser noted that the notion of a man-god or of a human being endowed with divine and supernatural power belongs to an earlier period of religious history where it was quite common that gods and men would be viewed as on the same order, but that the gods could become a human. Some of those gods are temporary incarnations, that is, a deity becomes human for a period of time to communicate something and then returns to the land of the immortals, or that a human could imbibe some substance or by magic become a deity for a brief period of time. But more commonly, in fact surprisingly common, are embodied deities. Krishna, is one of the most beloved and most famous of the 10 incarnations of the Hindu god Vishnu, for example. Vishnu becomes human in 10 incarnations, Krishna being the most followed. That is, God become human, even though Krishna did have a blue face, but nevertheless is a blue-faced human being. In fact, in India, and as well as China, there is a registration kept of the incarnate deities. Fraser lists this. He says, there's a register of all the incarnate gods in the Chinese Empire under Li Fan Yilan, the colonial officer at Peking in an earlier period, where incarnate deities could go on register. So the number of gods who took out a license was listed at 160. Tibet listed 30. Northern Mongolia had 19. Southern Mongolia had 57 incarnate deities. Well, my point is that the idea of incarnation, God become a human being, truly God, is not unique at all to Christianity. But the most significant example for our culture of a God who becomes immanent as a person is the Christian claim that Jesus of Nazareth is God, Jesus Christ. Christ is not Jesus' last name. It's a deification. It's a term of divinity. A more transparent title for this talk might have been, "What Do We Do with Jesus?" Traditionally, Christianity, whether Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox or Protestant, focused on Jesus as the divine Savior of the world and declared that Jesus was God, fully God, in fully human form. In contemporary American religion, Jesus has become even more pronounced as the exclusive location of the sacred, especially among evangelical Christians. But the religious hegemony of Christianity and missionary Christianity, especially over Western civilization, has posed a real problem for many who seek a deeper religious life and spiritual meaning. What do we do with Jesus? Some recoil at the name because of an uneasiness about what it implies. The most publicly visible form of Christianity in the United States today, in fact, is evangelical Protestant Christianity, who tend to hold a particularly exclusive focus on Jesus as Savior and as God. Jesus is the only way to understand the divine or spiritual life, is the claim, because Jesus was and is God. The Jesus story in Christian tradition is that God became incarnate, took on flesh, assumed a human nature, and became a man in the form of Jesus, the second person of the Trinity. That's a foundational Christian position that says the divine, all that we were saying about the transcendent, is knowable to us through the immanent human form of Jesus. According to Christian teaching, the transcendent God, who cannot be imagined or approached in God's essence, becomes knowable and immanent through Jesus the Christ, who is the incarnate second person of the Trinity. One of the scriptures, the letter of Paul to the Philippians, says that Christ, who though was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself and was born in human likeness. Humbling himself, he came to us in human form. It's important today, and this is a little bit heavy, I know, but we're going to keep going with this just a little bit and see where we take this. First of all, it's important to observe that that view of Jesus, this hierarchical, transcendent, but immanent human divine, was not the only view of Jesus in the original followers. That developed over 3 and 4 centuries before the triumph of Jesus as God co-opted all the other understandings. There were multiple views of Jesus among his followers in the early centuries. These included adoptionist views. Jesus was a human being just like any other human being who was adopted by God to represent the will of God. Some viewed Jesus as a miracle worker to be followed, but quite human. Others, a sage and prophet of a new age which was coming upon us. Some viewed Jesus as a mystic, close to the heart of the divine. The notion that Jesus is God developed late, at least in its robust and exclusive form. Under Constantine the emperor, it became the only orthodox or prescribed description of Jesus. But prior to that, prior to 325 and 350 and 387, these creeds, there were lots of different ways and options that were considered about the person Jesus, leaving also multiple ways of trying to understand and know the sacred, the holy, and the divine. Jesus was pointing a way to the divine and not was the divine for many. In the 19th century, European scholars and American scholars as well began to question those traditional understandings of Jesus as incarnate God. The Jesus scholarship in the 20th and now early 21st century especially moved that quest even farther. Some call it the quest for the historical Jesus. The Jesus seminar was built around this kind of quest for how do we understand the transcendent God, the divine, through the person of Jesus. The late New Testament scholar, I mentioned him earlier, Marcus Borg, who was a Lutheran Christian, never abandoned his Christian identity, would write this conclusion. Jesus was a Jewish mystic, a healer, a wisdom teacher, a prophet of the kingdom of God. He challenged the domination system and was executed by authorities and then by his followers was vindicated by God. Borg argued that it was only after an Easter experience, which remained ambiguous, that his followers began to use exalted language about Jesus. It's that claim that established Jesus as the embodiment of God. Jesus is the way you get God into the midst of our experience. But before that, Jesus was pointing to a way and was not the way. Perhaps the most prominent and controversial contemporary New Testament scholar, Bart Ehrman, I thought if Travis Proctor was here, most of you know Travis by now. Travis studied under Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman was his dissertation supervisor. So he really should be doing this talk. Anyway, you have one of the most prominent early century scholars in the United States today worshiping here almost every time we gather. That's Travis Proctor. Okay, anyway. But Bart Ehrman has studied this extensively and has written something close to 20 books on the topic of what do we mean by the divine and who is Jesus. And Ehrman in his own life reached similar scholarly conclusions to Borg about the real Jesus of Nazareth, but he drew very different personal convictions from his studies and he abandoned Christianity. For Ehrman, the real puzzle became how in the world did Jesus of Nazareth become a god? Ehrman wrote, "My own personal belief about Jesus has moved in the opposite direction of Christian orthodoxy over the centuries." Now, this might not surprise a Unitarian, since Unitarianism itself began as a kind of critique of Trinitarianism, especially in the exalted view of Jesus. So for Emerson and Thoreau and Chandler and the early American Trinitarians, that Jesus was indeed the greatest of spiritual teachers. But to call Jesus God actually shifted our focus from finding the divine in the middle of our lives to yet again another kind of transcendent, hierarchical, unreachable deity. Emerson especially he's called a transcendentalist, but argued that the transcendent dimension that we seek so much for our lives, to be inspired, is to be found in the imminent. It's right here, it's right now. And Emerson wrote eloquently about nature as the place where we find the divine and the divine experience. Jesus was an exemplar of that and a teacher of the way of love. Jesus points the way for all of us in our imminent experience to discover what is lovely and to discover love in us. So let me point towards a tentative conclusion. Human beings by our nature look for inspiration and guidance. We all do. We all have no moments where we feel lost or confused or unsure. And human beings long for ecstatic experience, sometimes associated with the transcendent. We know the ecstatic power of creativity, something new. We call that the transcendent dimension of our lives. And we look for that. But could it be that we find the ecstatic precisely in the imminent, in the mundane? Humans have looked longingly at the transcendent as the abode of spiritual life, as something out there, when in fact, it's right here. The imminent, in the world, in our lives. It's hard to see. It's hard to grasp. That requires meditation. It requires focus. It requires attention. It requires presence. But it's here, not out there. Even Martin Luther, in his meditation on Christmas, on the birth of Christ, he wrote this powerful little vignette about Christmas, and he said, "If you wish to understand the Christ child in the manger, do not look to God in the almighty heaven, but look to your own babies in your arms." That's Martin Luther, 16th century. Look to your own babies if you want to understand the reality of love in the world. Don't contemplate God in his majesty, but look upon your own child. So could it be that the transcendent is resolved not as that which is out there, but which is eminently right here? And could it be that it isn't so much Jesus to worship and admire, but who taught us to pay attention to the birds of the air and the lilies of the field and the community of people we find ourselves in, warts and all? But this is where we find the power of love and our spiritual lives, in their depth and in our hopes and in our dreams. Our puppies do indeed show us the way. They really do. Deb's remarks are, they awaken us to the delight of being a fresh fallen snow instead of crabby old men like me who crank about having to shovel the roof again. But it's true, the fresh new fallen snow is this delightful miracle, or the gust of wind as you so well describe, or our children, our babies, as we watch them. If you weren't here just last night, Skype, you know, it's this amazing thing. So we've got this little one-year-old and her older sister, who's this domineering little creative character. You know, but you watch them unfold and you see a miracle right before your eyes. And then, of course, it disappears. We get caught up in our daily life, but it's right there. That's the sacred. That's divine. Maple syrup is a sacred act. Those trees are divine. They are the entree to the sacred. That's where we find the power of God. Whatever we imagine God to be, is in the midst of our studies, our work, our families, our daily tasks. Our spiritual task is simply to wake up to what is already there, not pointing to something outside of our lives, but pointing to the best that is already in our lives and the best that waits for us still, no matter where we are in life's journey. It is always unfolding, even to our last breath. Whatever we mean by God is here, now, in and of us, and we share that in this community, and for that we rejoice. T.S. Eliot, the poet, said those words, "These are only hints and guesses, but the hint half guessed, the hint half understood, is incarnation, and that is the rest for us. That is our task, to see it in our bodies, in our lives." So, may that be so. Thanks.